Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics. Let's discuss how to create and improve your reliability program and your career.
Hi, this is Adam Bauer. Welcome to another edition of Speaking of Reliability. I'm here with Fred. How you doing, Fred?
Hey, good, Adam. Glad to be here.
Good. I'm just fresh back from the ASTR conference, Accelerated Stress Testing and Reliability Conference. We were in Austin, Texas, which is a very cool place.
Were they hit by the hurricane much at all? I'm trying to remember Harvey, I think. Couple months.
It's amazing. You know, Houston's not that far. And there were some people there from Houston who traveled. There's a lot of big tech businesses in Houston. And they were sharing their stories of just the insanity of it. And but those hurricanes are pretty precise, you know, even Austin, it's not that far away, really got nothing. They got a little bit of rain kind of thing.
So. Okay. That's cool. So good conference. They have a good turnout.
It was great. It's really funny. It's a smaller conference than like RAMS or bigger ones, but it's always one of my favorite because it is so specific. And the people who come there there's kind of this excitement of talking with everybody else and you know what you're going to be talking about. And there's not that, like when you go to RAMS, there's so many different things to see and do. And it feels a lot more like your Disneyland. It's just kind of scattered, you know, whereas.
I describe it as kids in the candy store because there's many different aspects from theoretical stuff to aerospace to medical to they're all there. Yeah.
ASTR feels more like an after theater party after, everybody came from the same thing and talks about the same thing, you know?
Okay.
And, so, you know, it's all accelerated stress testing. And again, as you know, when you and I go to conferences, we always end up being at the table that closes the restaurant down at the banquet. Mm-hmm. They kick us out. We have so much fun talking. And I ended up with a really fun table and we got to be that table again. And one of the things we were talking about, you know, we were sharing about our work and we also were talking about, you know, how the world's going to end. We covered both equally. Mm-hmm. I kept my vote solid in artificial intelligence and other people were thinking it was energy damage from energy consumption, but that was good. It got more and more interesting.
I wonder what side the folks from Houston were on that one.
Exactly. It all stayed friendly though.
So that's good.
But, you know, we did talk about a lot of work stuff too. And one really cool conversation I got into with, you know, I asked this, it was a very, two engineers, well, actually engineer and a fellow from this company, and they manufacture a type of drill that – I'm just going to call it a drill, but it's used for very, very detailed sculpting, shaping, and drilling, and it's handheld, and the required precision's astounding and really high. And so this was talking about the specific part of this that I found of great interest is because it straddles both parts of my career. My career started in finite element analysis, mathematical modeling of structures and thermal and vibration and things like that.
Oh, I didn't know that. Andre's got a similar background. Andre Kleiner's got it. Yeah, I didn't know that.
Yep, and actually the great thing with that is I thought as a mechanical engineer, I'd do it for just like 2 years, 3 years, you know, you kind of get, you do it to an extent and move on. But I ended up getting tied in with a physics group and I ended up actually, they liked that they pulled me in from R&D to like their physics group. And I started modeling like particle motion and vacuum, ion beams, magnetic fields. Like it was so cool. It got
deep in the physics world. Yeah.
Oh, it was crazy. And it was so cool to like have an ion beam, take atoms, rip electrons off. I'd calculate the electrostatic charges to accelerate it. I'd calculate then the magnetic field for how it's sorted out by atomic mass, the beams, like all this stuff accurately. And then I'd calculate how that ion beam would heat something and how it would heat it up. And then the rate of energy and how many particles. I do these models that were just, I mean, I got to the point where I hadn't talked to people in days of work. I really would get up and just talk to anybody I could find. I'm like, hi. But then I transitioned, obviously, into reliability and very testing-oriented approach to solving similar problems. You know, how do you design a test the same way? How do you build a model?
Right.
And so I asked him, what's one of your biggest challenges? And he's like, it is so hard to create a test protocol that correctly has the correct stresses, inputs, you know, what you call boundary conditions that will characterize how it's actually used. Because you have these very complex stresses. So picture something spinning, right? And it has cutting edges and stuff like that. So it's creating a very specific set of pulses. Now, one of your major dampening mechanisms is the person's hand holding it. Right. Talk about a crazy variable, right? And then the other is even characterizing all the frequencies and the way it changes, because it's an infinite number of positions you could be holding it against what you're drilling. You know, some of the cutting bits around, full surf spheres, and that's their biggest thing that they suffer with, is doing tests that then they can make statements they're confident on. And, you know, and of course that translates to if they want to model anything. And it was just a really fun discussion and to explore it, both with the engineer that was closest to the testing and the fellow, you know, the PhD fellow that, you know, understands, you know, the application at this.
The application of the environment. Well, there's a lot of situations like that, though, where it's... I remember one of the, I think it was a Mills standard that had, it was called the Four Corners Test. It was temperature and humidity. And it said, we're going to do low humidity and high humidity. I think it was like 20% and 80% or whatever nominal values they were. And then we're going to do low temperature and high temperature. We're going to do 5 degrees C and 80 degrees C. And use it as a two-way test program. We had 4 points and everybody was happy that if it passed that, it covered the sphere. And then, and that's reducing this model to, there's like not a lot of variability, right? It's not like a hand. It could be thinner or bonier or stronger or has more padding or not less padding or fat or different angles and different amount of surface area you're cutting. And then everything's moving, which is insane. Right. But even in a very, very, very simple model, we finally said, you know, this is crazy. Nobody lives in the very hot and dry or these corners of the two of the four corners nobody lives in, and the other two corners a lot of people live in, and we're missing part of it. So we just mapped what we knew where the customers were against that profile and changed our four corners to more of a squished looking system to reflect where our customers were. Now, in this drill problem, imagine that they're having people actually do the drill, and maybe they're measuring forces and stuff like that. But it's like a shipping problem. How much vibration do I get on a UPS truck? Well, instrument it, go measure it, and start building that database. But sometimes that's really hard to do, to get that data. And I think there's all kinds of problems with that, the way you describe this with all of those variables. And just going to the outer bounds, the maximums, may not be informative. It, because different angles and stresses may cause different kinds of problems for the precision piece. Whereas at the edges, it may improve the precision when you're at the edge of a person holding it very, very tight with a bony hand, basically, what I'm thinking of. So it's a tough problem to solve without having a lot of live data tracking of what's going on.
And there's no, and it's not a problem you actually really do ever solve. You just keep trying to get closer and closer. And that's what was fun to hear about and, you know, and to talk with them about that. And in contrast to other people who had very different other products, you know, home electronic products, and for them it's all about, you know, keeping up with the way the customer uses it, right? And that was their variability. Even though the application was very controlled, they wanted to know what combination of, you know, inputs or something. And it's like, yeah, it's so much fun. I love those conferences and always go to them when I can, because, you know, getting to see reliability from all these other perspectives and challenges.
You learn so much. I at one conference, I learned it broke my paradigm of how to do drop testing. Up until that point, it was, you know, drop different angles, drop different scenarios, different surfaces, and do it 5-10 times, and that's good enough. And I ran into this guy that was making the handheld baggage tag readers, the little barcode readers that look like a little pistol, or you see them now in grocery stores and hardware stores where they have a little portable barcode scanner, but they're not trivial little devices. They're not, right? They've got padding and bumpers and all kinds of stuff on. I said, well, how do you do drop testing for these things? First we did 10 drops at different angles and 3 feet onto concrete, and half of our units came back in the first week. they were dropped much more often and much harder and much higher. And so they went and watched baggage handlers and got throws and get run over. Bags would get dropped on it. They characterized more about their environment. So they went back to the designers and said, you know, that drop test you guys had struggled with, we're going to double it. You have to go 6 feet and 20 drops.
Yep.
And the number of field failures reduced, but then they realized if they went to 40 feet and 100 drops, they'd have even fewer field problems. And so they just kept raising the bar until the number of field failures was reduced enough that it was manageable.
Yeah, but the cost, you know, you're not balancing the other factors, just... Yeah.
Right. That was their number one failure stress mechanism was that.
Actually, it's so funny you say that, the barcode thing, because that was somebody else I talked to there. They made an electronic device that you would use at a cash register. Mm-hmm. It was complex. And, you know, their specifications are pretty clear. I mean, the environment you use it in is very consistent, right? It's like a cash register in a store, you know, temperature and all that. And they recently got one of the huge hardware store chains, mm-hmm. A contract with them. Mm-hmm. So excited. Huge volume, right?
Right.
Well, if you've gone to any of those huge hardware store chains, they have a garden section, which has the cash registers outside.
Outside. And it's got dirt and soil and water everywhere.
right. And all of a sudden, their design spec just changed dramatic, because you can't go and be like, no, you can't use them there. That's big chain's going to be like, you're out.
Yep.
So all of a sudden, you have to come back to the team and you're like, hey, guys, guess what?
New spec, new requirement.
The sprinkler systems are going to hit it and it's in the sun all day. And exactly. So that was another challenge, is what happens when your specifications change suddenly. You know, I basically have to be entirely rewritten because you have to satisfy
Things like that happen where it's not even that obvious in a upfront. We know we're going into that new environment, but it's a great product. We're going to, let's use this in the garden center. Let's use this in the construction field. Let's use it, you know, on the tarmac with baggage.
Right.
The first ones were just barcode readers. You know, it's like, well, it should work.
Well, that's how they found out. They kept getting all these, you know, returns and complaints and everything. And, mm-hmm. you know, it was never even thought of by the customer that would be an issue.
Well, that's one of the things I loved about conference. And I've been to a handful of the ASTR ones. And I agree with you. It's much more intimate and more focused. Yet I think any of these conferences, there's that opportunity. You don't know who's sitting next to you and what issues they're trying to solve. And it was one of the ways when I was at Hewlett-Packard that we justified the expense of holding a conference. It was an internal conference. But it still costs money to host and put on, and all these engineers had to travel and weren't doing their day job, essentially. So the return had to be there. And so instead of doing a post survey of saying, you know, how was the food? How was the lighting? How was the sound system? We knew that the hotel chairs were uncomfortable, so we didn't ask about that. But we didn't ask about any of that stuff, which are characteristics of what you can control in the environment of the conference. What we asked and said, what did you learn? What did you take away? And then we called the number of people that gave us, I had this great conversation, or I got this from this paper, or I picked up this topic from here and I'm going to explore. We called them about 3-4 weeks later, a good number of them, a sample of them, and said, you mentioned that you had picked up XYZ technique on, say, a data analysis thing. Did you try it? And most people said, well, it didn't quite work. I got back with them. We're still struggling with it. Or I didn't have time or whatever. But we got a small percentage that said it was brilliant. It saved us $1 million or some other number. They said it saved us weeks of time. It saved us, gave us an insight that solved the problem for us. And then we pursued, well, how much of a difference did that make? And we ended up categorizing with about 15 stories like that, over $15 million of savings in the first 6 weeks after the conference.
Wow.
Which swamped anybody's objection to holding a conference and complaining that, we got to do $50,000 and spend to set up the hotel. that's trivial compared to the savings that occurs because of those conversations.
Yep. Yeah, yeah, without a doubt. It's and it is hard to measure. It's pretty impressive you guys found a way to measure it like that.
Just go at, well, it was internal, so we could talk trade secret stuff. We
right.
could, you know, so right. we had the advantage. But you know, intrinsically, those conversations of what why you go, right? And those are the things you take away. And it builds network and relationships too. And that's not to be undervalued.
Yeah. Yeah. No, and it is funny how the person sitting next to you at your work might have the information you need as well. And yeah. Actually, it's funny we're talking about that too, because I'm actually reading a book that talks about different ways things can be created or innovation and things like that. And mm-hmm. one of the examples was how the CIA created formal reports for sharing information internally. Mm-hmm. And one of the CIA agents, this woman, this was back in like 1990, and she was observing the unbelievable amount of delay in information transfer and inaccessibility of it.
Right.
And she was one of the first ones to really push for like an internal, like what we call now Wikipedia type of thing, where effectively people blogged every day
right.
internally to share information. And you could, you know, search on, I mean, it's all stuff we're very familiar with now, but she realized how much all the information that they needed was there. And even between organizations, FBI, you know, the National Security Agency, CIA, and, it was this thing about so much the amount of information we're not putting together and processing is astounding.
It sounds like that connecting the dots kind of problem. It's if part of that is also just being aware that you can ask, and we have this huge bias for most engineers I've met have this is, well, this problem's unique. This is our problem. Nobody else has these problems or right. whatever yet. It's amazing to me is that when I've gone to conferences and you say, you know, have you seen an issue like this? You know, I remember asking about ceramic capacitors, which are not the sexiest component in the world, right? Yep. They're not the top of the design team's concerns of making sure you put them down right. Have you ever had problems with ceramic capacitors? And to a person, anybody that had electronics in their products has had problems with them. And then I run into a guy that's run into a failure analysis lab, and he goes, oh, we keep track of that. It's a third of our business is failed capacitors.
Wow.
You know, the third of the products that come in our door for analysis of what caused the failure is due to a capacitor failure. Mm. And it's like, you know, there's something there. There's more. And it's just those short, sometimes very short conversations that really open up stuff and make things happen. And you look at it a different way, you put it in perspective. But it also, another conference discussion I had was the guy that made washing machines. And I think I talked about this story before. My grandmother's cast iron, one switch washing machine ran for 50 years. Right. Right. And he says, yeah, we couldn't afford to ship them anymore. You know, it cost you $5,000 to get it to the store, much less to your house. And so we thinned them out and lightened them and lightened them and lightened them. We found out that if it lasted 10 years, it was good enough. And then people would buy that product again and our brand again. And it wasn't driven because of we wanted to strip out durability and reliability. It's just that it cost too much to ship it. It was just the transportation costs and the installation costs. And the people had to reinforce their floors to put those things on them in their newer homes. And the, you know, and he said, you know, and we wanted more features and we did all this other stuff. It wasn't that we stripped out reliability so you had to buy more, but that was a happy coincidence. We didn't want people to buy one product and for a lifetime. That's kind of bad market.
Yeah.
And I'm like, yeah, I see that, but it's got to last long enough that I get the value out of it.
Right, right.
And that was the conversation that just the guy sitting next to me, we were sitting down 10 minutes before the session started and started chatting.
What would you change then about the way people work internally in a company where more of that, something simple to where information flows more freely?
The best one I've seen by far, and I worked in a company that it was just, we put a chalkboard, and this was a long time ago, so it actually was a chalkboard. I think we eventually upgraded to a whiteboard next to the coffee pot, you know? And it wasn't right outside somebody's office, so if you're chatting there, it didn't disturb anybody. But we, instead of making it get your coffee and get back to work on your desk, it was go talk to people there.
And, yeah.
And our boss started a program where we got donuts Friday mornings or whatever it was. And there'd be 10, 15, 20 of us there swapping stories, problems. It was competition for space on the board some days. We also did, you know, quarterly reviews where everybody formally talked about what they're doing. Those were boring as sin until we had a break and we're all standing around eating food and talking. And then we talked about good stuff. And so
just add food. We're all just animals, right?
Yeah, there's that.
Anytime you add food, everybody just congregates.
We also had permission to do it. Nobody was chasing us away. Nobody was saying, hey, it's 9 o'clock, get to work. We didn't schedule meetings between 8 and 9 because that was chat time. That was compare notes and it's harder to do when you're dispersed. It can be done. You have Slack and Skype open rooms. There are ways to do it. It's harder to manage it. But overall, it needs to have permission. You have to feel safe and have permission to engage in shop talk with your colleagues and be able to say, hey, I'm not sure how to solve this problem. You got any ideas? In some organizations, that's not safe. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, people will come in early for that. Like you said, people who don't normally come in at 8 in the morning would probably come in at 8 because they'd be curious what people are talking about.
You know? And how they can help other people, how they can help solve problems or how they can get their own problems solved. But if the organization is, well, if you don't know, then you're fired. Well, that you're never going to admit that you don't know something and you won't ever bring that up.
Well, you won't speak up either for risk of. Yeah. You know, of that. So it's good. Yeah.
So I think it's a cultural thing.
All right, chalkboard.
Yeah. Chalkboard.
There you go.
Well, it might be, I don't know, you have to find allergy-free, you know, non-carcinogenic chalk and
bottle
oil, all that other stuff these days.
Exactly.
At least in California.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Cool.
You know, maybe we should do that. We should put chalk whiteboards up in the hallways at conferences.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that would definitely be a great thing to do. Without a doubt, you see people sketching on their notepads while they're talking and stuff.
Yeah.
That would be good. Yeah, see different, because then people, do you know what the thing that would do the most is when two people are having a conversation, if they were doing it on the whiteboard and that was known to be in a conversation area, other people would feel comfortable jumping in and not feel like they're intruding.
That's right.
That's actually a really good idea. Yeah. I like it.
I'll have to patent that.
Yeah. Good luck. Good luck reinforcing that legally.
Yeah, that's true. All right. Well, that's a good idea. I should share it anyway. Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah, so conferences are great. Hopefully, you know, if people are listening here and, you know, push your management to allow you to do it and explain why and make a case. You know, don't just ask and then walk away if they say no. Help make a case as to why it's so valuable and how it can help. It's definitely worth it.
Yeah. And I should mention that it's on the Sendo Reliability site, there's a section called Calendar. And the top level menu choice is a collection of all reliability-related events, conferences, seminars, workshops, courses, classes, evening meetings for professional sites, anything we can find. It goes into this Google Calendar. You can click through to the Google page on it and you can sort by location, you can sort by topic, you can do all kinds of stuff like that. And it's really handy to find these live events that are maybe occurring where you are or where you'd like to be. Other parts of that are the webinars. We've got paid and free webinars listed. There's a monthly email list that I think it's up over now, like 500 or 600 people now, Adam, that are getting a once a month email that lists. In some months, we're listing like 30 events. So you don't have to be on 25 different lists. You can get them all in one shot for the upcoming month. And some are free and some are paid, but it covers a wide range of topics related to reliability. And webinars are kind of, they're not as conducive to those off conversations with the person sitting next to you. Yet most of them have chat windows and get engaged on there. Engage in conversations during the event. Pick off topics, and oftentimes the better ones will have a second person online just to engage with those conversations and keep them going. Yeah. So those are a couple of ways you can get at it. And then look for the chalkboard next to the coffee pot. That's the
there
best.
There you go. That's it. Yep. The best. Cool. Good. All right. Cool. Well, that was a really good episode, and encourage people to comment on it and you know, chime in there. And again, advocate for getting yourself to conferences. So, all right. Thanks, Fred.
All right. Thanks, Scott.
All right. Take care, everybody. Bye.
Kirk Gray here. We want you to know that my company, Accelerated Reliability Solutions, is ready to support you with experienced leadership, guidance, and training to rapidly develop reliable, robust, and mature electronics at market introduction. To get started, go to accendoreliability.com/go/accelerated.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation. If you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show, please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.